I'll never get used to this.
I can get used to this.
How about you, Mike?
I'm just happy to have applause on it.
Welcome to Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. If you notice that's not our usual phone number, that's because we are not live this week. We are recorded. Actually, we're live right now, and if all goes well, we will continue to be alive on Sunday. But we are at Tacoma Community College with the Science and Inquiry Club for another live in front of an audience episode. Hello, audience. How you doing? And it's a lot of fun. The Science and Inquiry Club, Casey Rushford is the guy who is our contact point there. And, oh, I imagine he may be on the show at some point. But so we're at a school, which is weird because we're talking about atheism as a school. Very strange given what we talked about last week.
Well, it's a community college. It's not like we're in an elementary school auditorium. That would be a little weirder, but
yeah.
Awesome in a weird sort of way. The chances of us being chased out with pitchforks and torches certainly goes up.
Wow, that would be really fun. I've never been chased out.
I think being chased with weapons and fire is actually a bad thing.
I have nightmares about being chased off of school grounds with pitchforks since my day job is being a school teacher.
Ah, fair point.
So, I'm happy.
Education is education. So there is a really important topic out there that I thought we could use to ease in, folks in. But a lot of people, believe it or not, have been asking for our opinion on this. And it's a subject which is very important to the atheism community. And that's Star Wars being bought by Disney and J.J. Abrams being the director. And we got an email, Andrew from Calgary, and he writes, "Hello, Ask an Atheist crew. I would like to know your thoughts on the biggest news in the geek world, the new Star Wars movies. Do you think Disney will create the next Empire Strikes Back, or will it be more like the prequels or Tron Legacy? Was Tron Legacy bad? I thought people liked it."
It's got a bad reputation.
It had Bruce Boxleitner returning, right? Which is...
Yeah, hey, everything John Sheridan's fine by me. So, do you think it would be a good idea that they are writing an original script rather than sourcing one of the hundreds of Star Wars novels? Mike?
Well, obviously the last thing you want to do with any movie is say, oh, don't worry, this makes sense if you read a bunch of books. Because that's just a bunch of... No, nobody wants to do that.
I mean, right.
I'm sure there's like a hardcore fan out there that wants you to have to... It's like, if you're going to be a fan, you gotta run the gauntlet. But nobody wants that as a general audience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some real, it's with the, what do they call it, the expanded universe you told me about this last week?
Yeah, that's anything that isn't the movies.
I say he told me about this last week to hide the fact that I completely played the West End Games version of Star Wars, the role-playing game, when I was a kid.
I just know that you should never have to do homework on Wikipedia to have escapist fiction, because that makes absolutely no sense.
That's true. Well, so J.J. Abrams, I am a little concerned about one director being in control of both of American science fiction. All two of them?
All two of them. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm not as bothered by that. I guess he wouldn't have been my first choice. I would have liked to see him go in a different direction. But at this point, if it's not the George Lucas prequels, then you can only go up from there. I mean, those movies were just so awful that this is the first time I've seen some sort of corporate buyout of a intellectual property and thought that it's actually going to get better artistically.
I'm just hoping for something that rises above horrible ethnic stereotypes referenced at the intergalactic level.
Well, that would be if you got Michael Bay to do it. He'd probably step up on that. I mean,
that doesn't count as a science fiction.
That didn't even occur to me that it could be a possibility.
Well, it's got giant robots fighting, so yes, that is science fiction. But I mean, I imagine that everyone wants a little bit more racism and misogyny in their giant robot movie.
So let's hope for none from J.J. Abrams.
Okay. I think I'm ready to move on. So one of the things that we talk about on the show is blasphemy. Well, in addition to actually blaspheming, we've been talking about blasphemy laws around the world. I've done a talk on blasphemy, which will be on the show at some point when I get around to editing it. But we also have a segment on the show we call "And the Horse He Rode In On," which is about the use of blasphemy laws around the world. And lately we've been focusing on places like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the places where you expect them. But we should probably talk about blasphemy a little bit closer to home, like a couple weeks ago, or actually a week ago, when the president was sworn in on Lincoln's Bible. And according to Matt Staver, the head of the Christian organization Liberty Council, he says that Obama committed a blasphemy when he swore on Lincoln's Bible during his second inauguration on Monday, apparently because Lincoln stood for principles completely different than this president stood for. Staver did not give any examples on how Lincoln and Obama differed in on principles, but he considered it blasphemy nonetheless.
So if it's blasphemy to differ from the president from Abraham Lincoln, are we basically deifying Abraham Lincoln at this point?
That was my question. I really wasn't sure how differing on opinions can equal blasphemy.
So the movie was that good then?
The Lincoln movie?
Yeah, apparently.
The Lincoln movie was good, but I don't think that really has anything to do with it. The Liberty Council, if you're not familiar with them, you guys ever see that episode of Star Trek where all the good guys are bad guys and Spock has a beard? The Liberty Council is like the ACLU of that universe, where essentially their job is to get offended by anybody being allowed to not be publicly Christian.
Well, I think there is something here. We have a tendency, it goes back to mythologies, is... I'm not ready to say that there's an American religion, but there is sort of a slight deification of the Founding Fathers, I would say, is that to talk about the Founding Fathers in this country, you can walk on tread ice if you talk about them like historical figures. And I think, I get Lincoln is not a Founding Father, but he's often lumped in with them as like one of the foremen of the country or something like that.
Well, he's put up there in this upper echelon of presidents that everyone is supposed to sort of like unapologetically, and you forget the fact that these people were all human beings with flaws, and that in the Founding Fathers, not the pre-Lincoln one certainly, they still didn't ban slavery when they founded this new country.
Right.
That clearly this was not absolutely perfect. And then I like to think that our Constitution gets better over time, but it did not start out perfect. And that kind of mythology of perfection that these people are pushing out, that Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or Alexander Hamilton are these perfect, stalwart paragons of virtue, I think is a mistake, and I think it also makes history less interesting when you talk about these people as if they're just carved out of marble like Greek gods, rather than human beings that, while brilliant and often very, very, you know, I'm glad that they were the people in their place at their time, they're not these like biblical figures. They want to treat them in the same way that somebody would say speak about Moses.
Right.
And, you know, what this really speaks to for me is that blasphemy is such a universal sort of curse. You know, you say, oh, I don't like what you said. I don't like what you're doing. You are a blasphemer. And that seems to be like a go-to for someone with religious fervor to say, you're doing something wrong that I disagree with.
In the talk, I say that blasphemy laws are just censorship laws with a religious flavor. But this isn't even a religious flavor. This is just somebody attempting to censor somebody. Well, not even censor, but, you know.
Well, the word blaspheming kind of works like the word communist or fascist or a lot of other words that people don't actually need to know the definition of to throw out there like a weapon. But when you get into what blasphemy laws are, it's essentially rather than have an argument in which a religious leader might lose, they simply attack somebody for making an argument in the first place. They don't want to have that discussion. They don't want to challenge an idea being thrown at their idea. They want to simply just say that this debate is off limits and that you're a terrible person for even making it. And by questioning me, you're in fact persecuting me.
But specifically, I'd like to speak to the trend of sort of the deification of the Founding Fathers. I mean, is this... I think that there seems to be a direction in this way. There seems to be a way... you know, there's two ways to make religions, I guess. There's the revolutionary way, and then there's sort of the evolutionary way, I guess. And this is like slowly over time, the stories of the Founding Fathers have been worn away until they're basically Greek gods. You know, cutting down the cherry tree, there's a bunch of these apocryphal stories.
I can't tell a lie.
I can't tell a lie, stuff like that. And I'm concerned that there could be maybe a religious concept around the founding of a nation, which would really undermine the separation of church and state. And I think it's something we have to be careful of.
Well, I know that there's a painting that Sam is a big fan of, done by this fundamentalist Christian artist who... Sam had this as the wallpaper on his computer for a long time.
Yeah, that was great when I was a
client. Jesus is literally handing the Constitution to George Washington.
Yeah.
And it really does... you know, it meshes church and state in this creepy mythological way that when you look at people like David Barton, who's a pseudo-historian who mostly just tries to do Christian apologetics and pretend that it's U.S. history, that's really the sort of stuff that he believes. And there's people like Glenn Beck who are on national radio shows, and there are politicians like Mike Huckabee who buy into this nonsense. It's really kind of scary that this sort of thing is as mainstream as it gets. It's not mainstream in historical circles, but it's mainstream culturally.
Yeah. So I that's what it is. I think it's something we have to be careful of. But there's other blasphemy going on today.
Yeah, thankfully, this Obama swearing in on Lincoln's Bible was not at all actually against the law. But there's other places around the world where something that would be blasphemous would be legally actionable.
The government of India's Tamil Nadu state is objecting to the film Vishwarupam, a controversial spy thriller set in Afghanistan and the U.S. Police interrupted or prevented screenings across the state, and groups of Muslims gathered to protest its release. This is despite a ruling by a Madras judge who verified it has no scenes that hurt the sentiments of Muslim community. Actor-director Kamal Hassan expressed that he can't take it no more and wants to leave the country to a more secular place. I will look at all the states from Kashmir to Kerala. If I don't find one which is secular, I will leave for another country.
I guess what I find most offensive about this is it doesn't matter if it has scenes in it. It shouldn't matter if it has scenes in it that are objectionable to people. Brokeback Mountain has scenes that I'm sure would be objectionable to some Christians, but does that mean we should ban it so we can protect their tender feelings? No, we shouldn't. We shouldn't worry about things like that, because these sorts of laws are always going to be written with the most stringent, crazy fundamentalists in mind.
And really what's happening here is that there are groups of Muslims that are protesting the airing of this film. And what this blasphemy law does in India is to protect the sentiments of those who may be offended by something having to do with their religion.
But the other thing with blasphemy laws, you might notice that the Madras judge said there's nothing objectionable in it, but it didn't stop the protesters, is that oftentimes this anger comes out sight unseen, and it doesn't really matter if it's as offensive as the people say it is. Once this gets into the religious rumor mill and it's told that this is filth and that it's attacking you, that's all it takes to get mobs together.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that, you know, apparently nonviolent protest is as far as it's gotten, but we've seen examples of Salman Rushdie's editor, and I believe it was in Norway.
Yeah, he was his translator. It was the guy who translated the book for that country. He was shot at his home several times. He survived, fortunately. And the story there is he was shot, and from his hospital bed, he called the Satanic Verses publisher and said, "It's selling like hotcakes. I'd like to order 5,000 more copies." So, you know, I mean, that's a good story there. But the guy was still shot.
He's still shot. And I know there are other people that were affiliated with that book, The Satanic Verses, which was published in the 80s, who did die.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It's what I find so offensive about this is that, yes, you live in a free world. You are going to see things that offend you, that you're going to see something that is going to offend you to the very core, and you're going to have to learn to live with that. You're going to have to live with the fact that occasionally something offends you and not kill anybody.
And now let's map back to the United States, because we've got a very interesting law in Tennessee that's coming up, and we just heard about this. This is a Tennessee Don't Say Gay bill reintroduced. Tennessee State Legislature Stacey Campfield has reintroduced a bill to protect the youth of Tennessee. It would prohibit schools from discussing, acknowledging, or answering questions about homosexuality in most classroom contexts. An add-on with this round would also require that educators and counselors inform parents when students reveal that they might be gay, effectively mandating that teachers out their students. This is the same Representative Campfield who claimed that AIDS was caused by one guy screwing a monkey and then having sex with men. He also claimed that heterosexual transmission rate is 1 in 5 million. This is for AIDS. Finally, in case we were wondering where his religious convictions lie, observe his comments regarding his political party's losses during the most recent election. Look at the upside. We will get over it and win. God has a way of making things work out this way in his time. We are lucky in that regard. And since we're in front of an audience, I think it's worth saying that people do ask, why does an atheist show talk about marriage equality? And this goes back to something that we've been doing since the very beginning of the show. It's one of our very first episodes. I posed an argument or a question to our view at the time viewers and then to our listeners. I would like to see a secular argument against gay marriage, an argument that isn't based in religion, that has evidence behind it, that is fact-based, and that makes sense. We listened for over, well, our official listening period was for over 6 years, but we've been listening to that.
6 months.
6 months, right. But we've been listening the whole time. And we've never heard one. The most effective argument we've heard that wasn't religious was the ick factor. It's icky. Don't let it. You know, so we don't want it. And that's what it came down to. And so this is why we talk about it. And this is why Referendum 74 was very important to us in the last election.
But the ick factor argument, like you're just grossed out by something, I always think that that's a bit of a red herring. I've never bought that argument for a second. And I think that just think about the number of things that you feel icky about. Whether it's somebody wearing a fanny pack or socks with sandals or juggalos or any number of things that you just kind of go, there's plenty of things that I think are icky that I have no desire to ban or prohibit people from doing.
Right.
So when you really get down to it, I mean, there's no rational basis. There's no evidence to you know, prohibit speaking about homosexuality. And this is really, this gentleman from Tennessee says that it's to protect the youth of Tennessee. What we've seen is that youths, teens who come out in highly religious, highly fervent backgrounds are really unprotected from the bigotry and from the, you know, the pressure to conform to heterosexual lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's actually more damaging for students and for teens to be outed in those kinds of environments.
This is a textbook example of what I was talking about, how all of these laws and all of the arguments against marriage equality are coming from a religious basis. I mean, The funding for this is mostly coming from organizations like the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church and other ecumenical groups. And this guy, you know, this lawmaker is just putting these laws out there in the legislature because he has to. But if you even scratch the surface a little bit, you find a religious basis for nearly everything that he's doing.
And what's most insidious about this particular gentleman is that it mixes religious fervor with an anti-science attitude in the most virulent way. Someone who says that, you know, who disregards all evidence and historical, you know, evidence and scientific evidence and says that, you know, AIDS is a, you know, is a gay scourge and it was caused by human and simian sexual contact, to say it delicately and precisely. It's just this mix of religion and anti-science attitudes.
When I was in high school, somebody said that and he got at an assembly about AIDS awareness and got suspended for it.
Well, good. It's stupid, and it's amazing how many people who think primarily ideologically rather than factually are going to come up with stupid things. This is like the Richard Gere Gerbil thing. It just never goes away. And because it doesn't matter if something is true. It only matters if something is interesting and sexy and creepy and crazy, because that is going to make its way around the rumor mill way faster than something that happens to be true but isn't necessarily interesting.
If Icky is really a litmus test for laws, I could pass a lot of pretty terrible laws people wouldn't like.
Well, that's how politics works. Is
baptism.
Yeah.
Icky.
Yeah. Baptism is icky. We put holding your kid's head underwater.
Old Country Buffet. Icky.
I think tattoos are icky for me personally. Oh. And I think that a lot of people in our state and on stage might disagree with that law.
Carnivals.
Oh, carnivals.
Icky.
Carnivals are a little bit icky. But again, it doesn't really matter if I find it icky. If you try to
Pericomo.
Perry Como's, when you find out he has opinions, and he is really icky because the guy's a crazy old.
It goes on. If your gut feeling, and this is going to be a theme for the next segment, if your gut feeling is driving how you feel about stuff, if you're letting your gut drive how you make political decisions, about how you make decisions for your family, it's not going to work out well for you. This is not a skeptical position. This is not a smart position. This is not the way to positive outcomes.
But sadly, this is how politics tends to work. Largely success in politics is based on those emotional reactions. It's not based on somebody having the best evidence. In science, for instance, a person can be the most charismatic scientist in the world and have every single one of their ideas just bounce off a force field because they have no facts to back them up. It doesn't matter how smart or how funny or how charismatic they are. You put your ideas out there and suddenly your work has to speak for itself. It's going to have to run a gauntlet of a lot of scrutiny, where with politics, a stupid guy can become president.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. In a minute, we are going to completely disassemble an email.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. Oh, boy. Back in December, this is going to be a little bit different. Back in December, we, the very end of December, the last episode we did in 2012, we did something called Preventable Death in Washington State, which was something we did about vaccinations and how the lax vaccinations laws in Washington State have actually caused deaths. And we've been avoiding saying this outright. It's one thing when there's something in the news today and something that people in Western Washington, the Puget Sound area, like to talk about. And, you know, it's a very politically liberal place. And what people are talking about is Sandy Hook and how the school shootings there and the death of children is a signal to us that it's time to change the laws, that it's time to revisit the way we talk about gun violence and guns and stuff like that. And so I guess what I'm saying is, if your threshold for making law is the death of children, and Washington really needs to look at its vaccination laws, because more children have died, and because of lax vaccination, and because of the anti-vaxxer movement, than have died in Sandy Hook. And because it's one thing when a man goes into a school and pulls a trigger, but it's another thing when it's a systemic thing. It seems like in the mindset of liberals in Washington State, one is a protection of rights. You're allowed to vaccinate your children. You're not allowed to vaccinate your children. But the other one is rights that shouldn't be protected. And to be honest with you, this is an argument that I've never really quite understood.
Well, I think the difference is that there are a lot of people in this state who hold a lot of conspiracy theory views about vaccination, that they cause autism. I mean, these are things that have been debunked thoroughly and at quite length, and the people who have, I guess you could say the scientists that have pushed these views have been had their doctorate taken away. They're not allowed to practice medicine anymore. But these things just tenaciously hold on. But when somebody dies of a gunshot wound in an elementary school or is in a building that has a plane fly into it, we see those deaths in a very real, visceral, violent way, but we don't see somebody die of measles in that same kind of immediate, violent way. So sometimes we don't count it, even though the numbers on the death toll of people who are not vaccinated or children that are not vaccinated are much, much higher.
And the thing at issue here is that this is a combination of people refusing to vaccinate children based on both religious views and based on a lack of skepticism, views that are grounded in something other than evidence, than science, and taking a skeptical look at things. And Washington, just to recap, has a very, very lax law that allows for any religious or personal philosophical exemption from vaccinating your child. You can send them to public school, you can have them in daycares, and all you have to do is have a waiver that says, I have decided that I don't want my child to get an MMR shot.
After we did this episode, we've gotten some emails, and we were going to do several emails on this subject that we've received, but there was really one that we've received that really just covers all of the bases.
And stuck in our craw.
And all of them bad. And I'm going to do this a little differently than we usually do the show. Because we usually read the emails and then go through it, but this one is so long and has so many points. We're going to go at point by point, and I'm going to kind of talk while I talk. So this is Susan from Seattle, and she writes, I recently listened to your vaccine show. It kind of irritated me. You don't get to be that snarky until you've really thought about it from other angles. And I'm going to stop right there and tell you one thing. I maybe do an atheist podcast. I may do a skeptical podcast. But you know what I listen to when I go home? I don't listen to other atheist podcasts. I listen to conspiracy theory shows. I listen to anti-vaxxer podcasts. I listen to conspiracy theory shows at least 2 to 4 hours every day because I want to keep up on it. And honestly, I find it incredibly entertaining. I won't lie. But most of these people, no matter how well they put their arguments, these are the same type of people who go out with a radiation counter after a rainstorm and blame anything, any blip they hear on Fukushima, rather than on the scientifically accurate stuff like radon or mining or anything like that. And that's a problem. Just because I don't say every show that I listen to the other arguments all the time, that I've never heard them or I've never given them any attention at all.
So what this individual said is basically, here's all the arguments that you didn't smack down on your particular, 52 minutes on the air,
yeah.
And you must not be aware of them.
She says, I get that there are maybe some parents out there who engage in the non-Christian version of magical thinking about vaccines, but many of us are more willing to partake of technology's little treats, yet have learned from harsh experience to be as wary. I'm okay with being as wary. I'm okay with being wary. I'm okay with paying attention to things and being skeptical. We like skepticism.
Yeah, there is a difference, however, between skepticism and paranoia.
Yeah, and this email crosses that line. It's not enough to bring on experts, let them talk and agree with them. You can find experts in just about any field who will agree with you.
Not really.
One, not really. The anti-vaxxer movement is mostly Andrew Wakefield and his hangers-on at this point.
Andrew Wakefield is a British doctor who has published a paper in The Lancet, which is a British medical journal, which has been thoroughly debunked.
They retracted it from the journal.
He has had his medical license taken away, and he is the only one that's doing this. It's like 99.999 to 1 in terms of the weight of the arguments against him.
She's made a number of points, and I'm going to bring up the first point. Yeah, I'm just going to go through them. Suggesting that questioning of vaccine safety is the same kind of magical thinking seen in believing in a god, you really think that's parallel? Critics of vaccines can easily point out the multi-layered issues. Well, magical thinking is also multi-layered. Just look at Catholic theology. Just look at Hindu mythology. It's pretty multi-layered. The complexity of the argument says nothing about the veracity of the argument. And I would say that I would really say that this is almost the inverse of magical thinking, that this is really sort of paranoid magical thinking in this case.
Well, yeah, there's one thing to be skeptical, which is that I'm going to apply scientific reasoning to the claims that are thrown my way, but then there's the opposite of that, which is paranoia, which is I'm going to assume that everything I hear is a lie. That's not the same thing.
And the experts thing, what it comes down to is this is, we do have opinions on here, and this is an opinion show in many ways, but when we talk about the efficacy of vaccines, and we talk about the vaccination movement and its accomplishments, which is at this point mostly death and disease, these are not opinions. These are facts. These are facts backed by scientific data. They have gone through the scientific process. They've been published. It's been well studied.
It's gotten a lot of scrutiny, too. I mean, these things, of course, being politically controversial, get extra scrutiny compared to other things, and they have met the test.
They have met the test, and they continue to be open to scrutiny. All the time, we have different schedules or different recommendations. Just recently, I believe the American Academy of Pediatrics, or it may have been another professional organization, came out with recommendations for when pregnant women should get whooping cough vaccinations. And recently just said pregnant women should get the whooping cough vaccination during the second trimester of every pregnancy, no matter how far, how spaced those pregnancies are. Those are new information based on data that we continue to collect and scrutinize today.
So she goes on, you want people to be skeptical when it comes to questionable ideas, yet you seem derisive of people who apply that the same show-me attitude to the vaccine question. That's not true. There's a standard of evidence, and we ask that you follow it. And anti-vaxxers, for the most part, have this really strange standard of evidence that I've only seen in the creation movement.
Yeah, that or 9/11 truthers or any other person where no matter the
specifically
massive
the creationist movement, because the 9/11 truther movement, that's just a generalized conspiracy theory. Where the creation movement, they specifically have this scientific milieu and they have this standard evidence that's like scientific evidence, but is actually strange and non-logical.
Well, they both use the same cherry picking method, but they both have something that all magical thinking shares, which is that you have a pre-chosen conclusion and then you cherry pick evidence to back up that conclusion, and any place at which evidence contradicts your attitude, you claim that it's a conspiracy or a lie or a cover-up, and it's just nonsense.
So she goes on, and this is where the wheels come off a little bit. I got my son vaccinated late, and I did put some thought into it. When you have a real live kid of your own, it quits being an intellectual argument and gets very, very personal. Well, one, congratulations on vaccinating your kid. Thank you for seeing what it is. But here's the thing. I understand I don't have a kid of my own, but you know, earlier in the email, Susan is talking about logic, Susan is talking about scientific evidence, but then we get to this point where she says it quits being an intellectual argument. If it quits being an intellectual argument, you're not really participating in this discussion. You're not making good decisions for your children. You're just following your gut. And that's a great way to breed terror, but it's not a great way to prevent disease.
The emotional and sort of personal arguments can be a great motivating factor to investigate further and say, what is the evidence say? What is the consensus from a scientific perspective and from a skeptical perspective?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter in the end. When it stops being an intellectual, and this is personal, I know this because I'm a mother, I feel this, I see this. Those are often very emotionally compelling arguments. They tell a really good story. But unless they have a basis in fact, it doesn't really matter. There are a lot of parents out there that are convinced that maybe their epileptic child is possessed by demons and they need to take them to an exorcist. And I understand how scary it is to see your child go through something like that. But your emotional feelings and attachments to that doesn't make your solution true. Just because you really want something to be true, just because you have these deep, complex feelings that I couldn't possibly understand, doesn't change the factual basis for the things you're doing or the things that you believe.
And she goes on to write, I did a lot of reading on introducing foreign proteins into the system of a baby possessed of an unformed immune system. Which is an argument that didn't make much sense to me. But the unformed immune system and the introduction of foreign proteins, apparently didn't read enough, because introducing foreign proteins to an unformed immune system, whatever it is how you develop an immune system. It's how it works. A stock immune system doesn't do a whole lot for you. That's the whole vaccination concept. That's how the body fights diseases. They get these things in their system, and the immune system responds to it, and then it builds antibodies. I learned this in the second grade.
It is one of the things that we actually did directly address on the show, and so Susan just apparently wasn't listening or refused to believe that. I think one of the examples we used is, just because I get a new iPhone or a new computer doesn't mean that it's an unformed computer. It just means it's not populated by programs and documents and applications and things like that.
Yeah.
Essentially, using the computer analogy, getting vaccinated is like getting an antiviral software package on your computer. It's not like, oh, you're going to make your computer sick. No. What it's doing is putting something on the system to protect it from things that might come at it.
Well, you did it this time, but because I'm a computer guy, I try to avoid computer comparisons in this case. And now comes the logical fallacy section of our show. I looked at other developed countries who have better infant mortality rates than us and saw that many of them vaccinate less and or later. So there's a real basic one here.
Where did the most recent mumps sort of epidemic or break outbreak come from? Austria, France, Germany, all developed nations that have alternate schedules or popularized alternate schedules for vaccinations.
Looking merely at infant mortality rates isn't going to cover the vaccination problem entirely. It's only going to cover a small portion of it.
Yes.
And again, correlation is not causation. That you could say, for instance, that all of these dictators and despots that we've had in our history all have facial hair. Somehow is saying, oh, well, the facial hair was the problem here. Hitler had a mustache. Stalin had a mustache. That is not what caused it. And the fact that you can correlate something isn't good enough. You actually need to prove the connection between a cause and an effect, and she's not doing that.
So part two, being married to a scientist, no one is more prone to dangerous hubris and confirmation bias than someone with a lot of training, such as a doctor or a scientist. What?
No.
No, that's just no.
I could think of someone also equally or more prone to dangerous hubris and confirmation bias. Maybe someone with particular religious fervor,
right,
that would go to all costs to confirm their, you know, predetermined assertion.
And I get the I get that the high pressure publisher perish concept in academia and research can drive sort of a very personal attachment to certain theories. But there's also a psychological concept where the more you know about a subject, the less, I can't remember the name, I'm certain somebody out here does. The more you know about the subject, the less you feel like an expert on the subject. So there's actually
imposter syndrome, actually.
Yeah, and there's, well, I don't think that's it. There's another name for it. So there's forces against it and forces for it. And I can't believe that somebody who listens to our show is going to think a doctor or a researcher or a scientist is going to be...
Is going to know less about vaccinations than somebody who isn't, like, say, a former Playboy model.
Yeah. He's going to have more confirmation bias or more hubris than, say, the entire Catholic Church or that,
like,
we talk
Pope.
About. Yeah, the Pope.
Yeah, one of these people says that they speak for God and that they're infallible, and the other one does not. I mean, when you have a scientist on CNN or something else and they want a really punchy phrase from them or make some sort of judgment, a scientist is going to put more qualifiers on the things they say than just about anybody you have on there. And here's the thing. Yes, people are capable of hubris. People are capable of confirmation bias. And the scientific method recognizes that.
Yeah.
You, one person going up and saying, I have this great idea, let's put it all in the textbooks. That's not how it works. They have to run the gauntlet of all these other people who are going to say, okay, did you really do your work well? Did you cross your T's? Did you dot your I's? Were you not sloppy, and were you not really anxious to get to a certain conclusion? And if they find that you did, they toss you out and say, go back to formula.
All right, so there's a lot more here, but the thing is that she addresses a bunch of pro-vaccine arguments she assumes we subscribe to. She says that, why would anyone have any reason for wanting to lie? Yes, Google a picture of a pharmaceutical company executive's mansion. I don't really care about the pharmaceutical companies. We didn't talk about the pharmaceutical companies. We look at the evidence. Keep that stuff outside of it. You need to look at the evidence. When it comes to pharmaceutical companies, look less at their mansions and look more at study sponsorship. Look at the details. Look at the evidence. Look at the information. Look at how it's collected. Look at who is collecting it. The government says vaccines are safe. Surely they would never lead me astray. Take a minute to read about blah, 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 stuff that the government has done. The Tuskegee experiments. Terrible stuff. But it's not just the government saying these things. It's doctors saying this. It's the vast majority of doctors. So either vaccines work, or there's this enormous conspiracy that involves all of the government and 99% of reputable doctors on the planet.
Yeah, and this idea, yes, pharmaceutical companies often will lobby for really crappy laws, but does that mean that their products don't work? Because that's all that really matters. I'm so tired of this idea that one person does one thing bad, therefore let's just assume they're lying about everything.
So let's review the government-created dairy management, which runs ads encouraging people to eat way more cheese and milk than is healthy, thus leading them to heart disease and diabetes. Again, a government thing. This is not about the government. The other thing is, but my doctor recommends the vaccines and says they're safe. He went to medical school. Flashback to the fact that thalidomide was widely prescribed and many affected children died or lived with severe deformities. That was some time ago. We've been using vaccines for 100 years or so, or for a very long time, and if there were those sorts of effects in vaccines, we would have seen them by now.
And there is
no link between autism and vaccines. None has been found.
There is no statistically significant link, causal, anything between vaccines and autism. That is true. And we do occasionally see things from vaccines. They reformulate. They see whether they're ineffective. We say we're going to move up boosters, things like that.
The other thing here is this ignores scientific progress. Yeah, a long time ago, the medical industry makes mistakes. The medical industry will continue to make mistakes. We understand that. But the way to solve these mistakes is not to give in to fear, but to look at the evidence, is to not make your decisions based upon a biological drive, but based upon skepticism, the evidence, and looking at the facts. This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're going to the break, and when we come back, we're going to take some questions. So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm going to be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert.
Wow, that's so credible.
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you and to give me your lunch money.
Aw, anything for family. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We are recorded live at TCC, Tacoma Community College, with the Science and Inquiry Club, who on Valentine's Day will be having a Send an Atheist to Church auction. That's all I know right now. That sounds fairly awesome. An auction for it is a good idea. We actually have our usual call screener, Darren Garvin, has what Mike likes to put it, he has a tendency to find weird churches and good bars. That's basically what he does. And every Sunday, before he comes and call screens with us, he goes to a church, and then he comes and talks to us about it. It's very strange.
Yeah, the weirder the church is, the more he wants to go. So if they're flopping around and thinking they're possessed by the Holy Spirit, he's all over it. He just wants to sit there like Jane Goodall and just sort of take notes.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things is, you know, a lot of religious believers say that atheists are only atheists who don't believe in, or we don't believe in God merely because we've never been exposed to the Bible or to your particular religion. So this is a chance, I think, for atheists to say, I checked it out and that doesn't really check with me.
So where would they go if they wanted to participate in the Send an Atheist to Church auction?
All right. So the cafeteria at TCC is where we're going to be holding this. And I call it an auction because I don't know what else to call it. What we're trying to do is raise money for the club so that we can get a few more students to be able to go to the Northwest Free Thought Alliance Conference in Portland.
So who's bidding? Is it churches? That'd be funny.
So what we're going to do is we're going to have a little slip of paper, and you can donate any amount. Each dollar will count as a vote. And you put down your church and your religion of choice. The religion that gets the most votes, you know, the most donations, is where the club will basically go for a day and be exposed to that particular church or mosque or temple or whatever.
Go Church of Scientology.
Yes, Scientology is a viable option. Please don't.
Well, it's an option anyway.
Yeah, well, it would be fun. I mean, you get to see a movie and maybe sign a billion-year contract while you're
there. Yeah, and you know,
and
we can
get your name on
our
mailing list.
Tested.
Hey, you get to meet L. Ron Hubbard. All right, so we should take some questions from the audience. So just go ahead and say your name.
Hi, I'm Dave Strayer. I'm the advisor for the club.
Oh, wow.
Not so much a question, but a couple things to comment on up there.
Go for it.
One is the recent case of measles that went through SeaTac, and that's going to have impact around here because measles is highly contagious. Another thing that bears a bit of mentioning is I've been seeing my classes really hit hard by people who didn't get flu vaccines.
Yeah.
We last week covered actually the case of a few nurses who refused to receive the flu vaccine, and they lost their job. Their workplace said, you know what, you're a danger to our clients, to our patients, to our families. It's one of the most effective ways to minimize flu in vulnerable populations.
We got some response on that about how it's a personal liberty issue, and that always bothers me, is the idea that you, my personal liberty is to become a vector of disease to immunocompromised people. I don't really get that.
Well, the thing is, you're not just taking your health in your own hands. You're taking the health of all the people around you, including people who are very old. And in the case of the nurses in the hospital, they're going to be around people who are going to be on immunosuppressive drugs. They're going to be on people who are infants who have not been immunized. You're going to be around a lot of people who, yeah, I can take it. What's the big deal? Well, a lot of people can't. And those people may actually die from the thing you just shrug off in a couple weeks.
Fair enough.
So this is Casey again. I'm studying molecular biology, and the thalidomide topic has come up in my classes. And the Susan, was it? The emailer?
Yeah, Susan.
She should recognize the fact that science caught on to the problem with thalidomide, and they have since rectified the problem by creating standards of regulation. You know, what happened was there was a particular isotope that was just fine, but it mixes with another kind that is not at all okay.
Yeah.
And they did not do enough testing. So science may mess up every now and then, but they learn from their mistakes. And this is why we need vaccines.
And so, another thing that concerns me about the anti-vaxxer movement and the anti-GMO movement, while we're at it, is that the hysteria and the emotional component to it really covers. It makes it difficult to do real science in some cases, because if somebody actually finds an actual problem or an actual error or something like that, in the social domain, now they have to get above the noise floor of the weirdos. They have to scream over Alex Jones. That's hard to do. So, you know, it's very difficult to... when you make these anti-scientific arguments about scientific theories, it actually hurts... It can hurt your cause actually more easily than serving your cause.
And one of the things that was really beneficial that came out of the terrible case of hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of children being born with birth defects from thalidomide was that there's much better post-market research and pre-market testing of drugs that are prescribed to all sorts of populations.
I wouldn't say necessarily that science failed in that. I think that people failed to do the research. And I think that oftentimes what happens is science will often find an aberration. And I think that the emotional component is that a conspiracy theorist, an Alex Jones type, will see that in the news and just go, well, occasionally things don't quite fit in this perfect little box. And they go, oh, that's the proof right there. And they immediately go into this Soylent Green type hysteria that there's, like, in every one of these post-apocalyptic dystopian future movies, oh, there's this terrible secret behind everything, and there it's the beginning of it, and it's made out of people. And it doesn't help anybody, because oftentimes 2 weeks later they go, oh, it turns out that's just an aberration. But that's already gotten started. The crazy thing is just off and running, and there's no way to stop it.
So is that what we got for questions? So anybody else? Oh, go for it. I'm going to pretend like I don't know who you are.
Hi, my name is Wesley, and I was curious what you thought about Meryl Dorey stepping down from the AVN. Do you think that's kind of like a nail in their grave?
Can you give us a background?
Meryl Dorey, the Australian Vaccination Network. She was the leader of that for many years, but...
Okay. Well, I said earlier that the science behind the way that they do science in the anti-vaxxer movement looks a lot like creationism. And Mike compared it to the 9/11 movement. I think the social arc is a lot like the 9/11 movement, where the 9/11 movement is still out. The 9/11 truther movement is still out there, but they're like the Kennedy assassination guys at this point. It's a little cottage industry that people only pay attention to when they need weird opinions from somebody.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little confused. I'm not really aware of that story, Wes. Can you give us a little background? Did she drop out of the anti-vax organization because she changed her mind, or because she was thrown out, or what happened?
Well, supposedly, you know, she was basically their leader. She put out a quarterly newsletter. She was actually an American transplant down to Australia. She just basically dropped off the radar. She was very big on TV and YouTube videos for some reason. But
YouTube videos is the,
those
is
are
the
always
main
true.
Propagation medium of these conspiracy theories now. And, well, of what we do too, in a way. So I guess it's got its good sides and its bad sides, right?
Well, the internet is always kind of a double-edged sword. It's just that everybody can use it. The downside is everybody can use it.
Yeah. Fair enough. Any other questions? Anybody got anything they'd like to say? Anything? Oh, okay, cool.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I go to TCC, and I'm kind of just getting my AA degree. But I just wanted to say that I never get the flu vaccination because I feel like it's important to receive that kind of bacteria that doesn't kill you, but you go through it and you let your body go through it. And
strangely enough, I used to think that way as well, but there's good reasons not to.
The process of gaining immunity, whether it's introduced via an injection into the arm or introduced via nasal passages, your body has the same kind of reaction to it. But if you get an injection, you are not then propagating the virus through your own spittle and making it, you know, making yourself contagious to others. You may do just fine going through a week of feeling really down and crummy and having a cough, but all those 6 days, those 8 days, those 10 days that you're coughing, you may come into contact with hundreds of people who may come into contact with others who are immunocompromised and aren't able to have the same kind of reaction and robust immune system that you are. And that's why vaccinations and immunity through injections is really, really important and very valuable for community health.
We tend to think of vaccinations as a very, you know, it's foreign proteins and it's antibodies, you know, and it's stuff that's in your body. But we are not islands. We are not isolate creatures. We exist in a social substrate. And when we talk about diseases and stuff like that, we have to think about ourselves too. But the other thing is, there's a way more, you know, it's apparently the science is that it's the same immunological response when it's a vaccine, but it's not alive, so you're not going to get this
sick.
This huge sickness thing. And that's fine when you have really great medical coverage and stuff like that. That is not a winning strategy in 1918. When there was a major flu epidemic going on that was killing millions of people. I think in 1918, influenza killed more people than World War I did. And so, and this is what changed my mind on it, is that there's a, you know, maybe for a cold or for something like that, it's one thing, but honestly, you don't know when it's going to end up being this terrible epidemic.
I think for me, I've never gotten a flu shot myself, not out of any ideological objection, just out of pure laziness.
Well, learn something every day.
And some years I'm like, oh, I didn't get sick. And some years I get really, really sick. if I can choose between a sore arm and $25 and getting really, really sick and potentially losing work days or getting my coworkers sick, and I work in retail, so I encounter thousands of people in a week. So the odds of me getting sick from the flu are actually higher than a lot of other people. So.
I sense a show topic coming up.
So I am going to get a vaccination.
Why Mike doesn't vaccinate?
Well, I am vaccinated. I got, you know, as a baby and things, but I think that
one of those health videos.
Basically, a vaccine is not injecting you with the virus. It's tricking your body into thinking it's been injected with the virus, so you create the antibodies to protect yourself from it.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Jeremy. I'm a student here at TCC. I've been an atheist since I was about the age 10 when I started questioning my faith itself. And because of the rejection from my faith, I've had to remain in the closet, so to speak, for many years, and even through the years of being in military service. And yes, I was an atheist in the foxhole. Hmm. So that cliche can go ahead and go away. But recently, I've actually came out. I've been more almost militant about it. And my wife has finally become aware as well. She's okay. Rejected her faith as she was brought up. But she fears the rejection from her family. And my in-laws are, one side is fundamentally ingrained in Christianity, while the other one is Southern Baptist. So she fears telling them about our choices and our decisions and her realization. Do you have any confiding stories that I could probably relate to her to help boost her confidence in her decision to let them know?
I can't really give you a rah-rah story. I was incredibly lucky in that I never had very religious family, so that it was never an objection. But I'd say this, that it may be rocky for a long time, and they may say things that seem hurtful and that they would burn bridges. But if they really love you, then eventually they'll learn to deal with it. And I'd say give them some space to come to that realization. Tell them, and then just kind of back off for a little bit and let them learn to deal with it. And they may say nasty things for a long time. But if they really love you, they'll learn to just be something that they get over.
One of the things that people leaving religion sort of miss is the community of their church group or their family group. And recently, I think in the past decade, there have been all kinds of groups that have sprung up to create these sort of support networks that are missing or that are comparable, that offer the same kind of support as, say, a church community. The internet has gone a long way towards creating those spaces. There's some great groups all around the country through Recovering from Religion that deal with this very thing. There's also things for sort of mixed couples where one person is a believer and one person is a non-believer. The head of American Atheists himself, David Silverman, is married to a woman who is religious. And you know, there's all sorts of sort of support networks out there. You got to find them. The internet is a great resource for that. Meetup.com has gone a long way for a lot of people. There's a lot of different discussion boards.
Within the concept of a family, things have happened to me because I decided to be a public atheist. And one thing I noticed is that when I finally said outright, I'm an atheist, that gave other people, you know, in sort of my family group, the strength to change their opinions, or not even change their opinions, but it gave them the strength to question, to know that that was within their family, that there was already somebody who was questioning there with them. Is, you know, people would come to me at, you know, at family gatherings and say, so you're an atheist, what's that like? How do you live with yourself? Well, not like that. Well, they tell me that anyway, but it's not about atheism. And they want to know what it's like, and they say, well, I'm kind of in the same place, and like, you know, but your family's kind of, you know, your immediate family's kind of religious. And they go, yeah, but it's okay. So sometimes being the first is hard. It always is. Being the first one in the family to say X is kind of difficult. But you have to hold on to the idea that maybe you're making it easier for other people in the future, for other family members to know that they don't have to adhere to this fundamentalist ideology. And I guess that's one way of taking one for the team. But the other thing is, like, Becky's family, you know, your dad.
Sam and I are a couple.
Yeah, we're a couple, if that's not clear. When we started dating and she told her parents about me, one morning her dad woke me up around 11 because I was on vacation, and said, "Hey, we're having peel and eat shrimp." And I'm like, "Yeah, I love peel and eat shrimp." And I'm groggy, so I'm walking out to the table and we start eating peel and eat shrimp. And about halfway through, I go, "Wait, shrimp? You guys are Jewish. I didn't think you ate shrimp." And he goes, "No, I'm an atheist, man. That's cool." And I'm like, "Oh, nice." What I didn't know is that I am the first person he ever told.
Nobody else in his family told me first.
Hi, my name is Christy. This isn't really a question so much as a comment on the earlier comment about receiving the flu vaccine.
No, we're 3D.
I have one thing to say about that. I'm a generally healthy person, but due to some medical issues I had a few years ago, I can no longer receive the flu vaccine,
right,
the regular version of it anyways. For me, this is not a big issue because I have medical insurance. I'm generally healthy. However, I have a very good friend of mine who has lupus, mm-hmm, and she can be severely immunocompromised at various times. If I'm exposed to the flu, I can carry that to her, and right, she could die.
And that's why people around you, if you can't vaccinate, that's why people, and this is what herd immunity is. It means other people have to vaccinate. So
it's definitely something that people should pay a little bit more attention to, because I don't think a lot of people realize just how delicate of condition some people are in.
So we're running up to the top of the hour. I think we got one more question. Then we'll go.
Hi, I'm Pat, former research microbiologist.
Oh, wow.
Regarding vaccines, there's two types, basically, mm-hmm, generally. Attenuated, which means weaker strain. That's commonly what's used in flu. And then there's fully dead virus. Mm-hmm. Now, you can get a vaccination, then have to go through a small sickness level, a very small immune response. Usually you don't even notice. You might feel groggy for a day. That only occurs with normally attenuated or reduced or unhealthy virus types. Mm-hmm. But if you get wild type out in, such as influenza, you get the full immune response, which actually caused your immune system in some ways not to rebound as well as it would have just going through with a normal viral response, which means you get the antigens introduced in your system, and basically you have a proper immune response. If not, you go through a huge fever, all the bad intestinal things that go on with the flu, and you actually come out with less immunity you would have had if you went through a proper immune response with proper viral response to through normal inoculation. So.
This is one of those situations where we're on the stage and it feels kind of wrong, because there's a lot of experts out there and it feels like maybe we should be watching you guys. So this is Ask an Atheist. My name is Sam Olvey. With me today was Rebecca Friedman and Mike Gillis. I'd like to thank the Tacoma Community College Science and Inquiry Club. Ask an Atheist is an NEPM Media production. Again, we're at the Ale House. If you're not, this is pre-recorded. Check the website for where we're going to be on Sunday. See you guys next week.